This is Edward October, host of October Pod on YouTube. Hear that jingle jingle? It could be Kris Kringle, or a home invader looking for an open window, a jilted lover looking for revenge, or a disgruntled co-worker hoping to spike your eggnog with arsenic. The girls of our true crime podcast are always on Santa's nice list, but the crimes they discuss are very naughty indeed. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm hanging in there.
Woo-hoo.
Today is the seventh nightmare of Christmas. Woo-hoo. Before Christmas. We're getting there. We're almost done. Then we're going to take a little breaky break, a little month off, I guess,
yep.
Give or take.
I believe we will end Christmas Eve with the 12th nightmare before Christmas.
12.
And then we will take the following off, and we won't be back until January 13th. And we would have come back the first week of January, but I have oral surgery on the 29th, and we want to make sure that I am able to speak before we come back.
You don't need to speak, Jen. You know what? I would love a podcast with us, and you just don't speak. That would be great.
I can do that on this one. I can do that on this one. I know. I'm sure a lot of our listeners would agree, feel the same.
But, Lord.
Yeah, I'll be quiet on this one, and then you can just carry it on your
own. I mean, nothing. Wouldn't that be funny? Kind of like the Marx Brothers where Harpo didn't ever say anything, except it would be on a podcast.
All right. Hey, you want to bring it to us?
Yeah, I will, because it's kind of a longer one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of info going on here, so probably we should get started.
All right.
All right, here we go. 44-year-old Etta Kane went out on August 19th, 1979, to hike in the trails of a park at the foot of Mount Tamalpais. And that's a scenic park that overlooked the San Fran Golden Gate Bridge. It's in Marin County, if you know where that is. Jen, we've been there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember. Remember when we went to Sausalito?
Yeah.
Over there?
Mm-hmm.
It's that part.
In
it's
California, absolutely. In the United States, correct? In case those
correct.
People do Today, not understand.
I said San Fran.
You said San Fran, yeah. But I just wanted
yeah.
to. For yeah, our out-of-town listeners, out-of-state, out-of-country
yes.
listeners.
Out of town. Oh, I got you.
For those that aren't family.
So usually Etta would enjoy these hikes with a friend or two, and, you know, she had tried to find somebody to go on the hike, but nobody was available. So on this particular day, she went ahead and went on her own. Now, when Etta did not return home that evening, as she was expected to do so, her husband called police, worried that perhaps, you know, she fell and hurt herself. The police put together a search team. They got out there. They searched for her the rest of the day into the night, and they never could locate her. The following day, Etta's body was located. She had been attacked from behind and shot with a .44 caliber gun. Now, witnesses came forward to tell investigators what they saw. They would describe two men, a blonde one who was kind of fidgety and kind of just seemed like something was up. He wasn't quite acting right.
Mm-hmm.
Another man who was wearing a dark jacket and he was kind of shielding his face, like hiding a little bit with it, you know? And this is August, but it is Northern California, so it is a little chilly. So you could wear a jacket. That's not so strange, I don't think. The witnesses guessed that the men would be around 35 years old. Okay, at that point, you know, they don't have a whole lot to go on, but that's the case often. When the autopsy came back, it showed that she had not been raped, and with not much in the way of evidence other than the type of gun, her case would go cold. It would go cold until the killer would strike again. Months passed by until March of 1980 when Barbara Schwartz, aged 23, was found murdered. Now, this one would be a bit different for a few reasons. On March 8th, Barbara took her dog for a walk in the Mount Tamalpais Park. A man approached her and all of a sudden started stabbing her viciously in the chest and about the chest, the front, the back, everywhere. Barbara tried to fight with the man, but the stab wounds were too many and she fell to the ground. The man fled immediately. This attack was different because he used a knife rather than a gun, but there's another big difference. This time, there was a witness. There was a lady that was in the park hiking as well, and once this started, she stopped and she was like, kind of hiding behind trees and actually watching what was going on. Could you imagine seeing that? And you can't step in unless you had a gun. You know, he's got a knife. You can't step in. Barbara's autopsy would reveal 12 separate wounds to her chest area. The woman that was watching nearby ran to get help. And I'm obviously, she was shocked, stunned, and just kind of like, oh, what happened?
And so police, yeah, totally in shock.
Police arrive on the scene and they question her. She would describe the perpetrator as a man with dark hair and a hawk-like nose. He was also wearing hiking boots. Police would find a pair of men's bifocal glasses with blood on them at the scene. The police are ever so helpful and pretty sure that these glasses could belong to the perpetrator. Now, they scanned the park, they went through, and they were looking for more witnesses to see if anybody saw anything. Another witness came forward claiming that they saw a man in his 40s in a raincoat, and it is a sunny day this day. Mm-hmm. He was also wearing similar glasses to the ones that they found. Now, no one would know it yet, but the woman's eyewitness account was probably not very accurate due to shock and just being, you know, stunned. And they would later determine that probably that second witness was the more correct description and was probably the perpetrator. And we kind of know this because we know what happens as we move on.
We do know. I would hate to be described as hawk nose.
It made me picture it because I was like, huh.
Yeah. But then again, you know what? He's a bastard, so it doesn't matter how he's described. Sure. I only get really bothered when it's the victim, I guess.
Thank you. So it's only a few days later when a group of kids were playing in the park and they come across a 10-inch boning knife and it's covered in dried blood. It's kind of caked with dried blood. Ugh. An excited news reporter got to the scene before the police and he actually handled the knife, contaminating any fingerprints that may have been on there. Now, the glasses found at the scene earlier were, in fact, determined to be prison issued. So at this point, officers, investigators, and us can assume the killer has done some time in prison.
You would think by 1980, they would know not to touch anything on the crime scene.
Right? Probably young and naive and was excited and I don't know.
Yeah, but still, come on.
You would think, right?
Oops. Sorry I ruined your investigation. Yeah.
Right? And this is now, mind you, too, this is victim two. There's a many more to come, right? So that it could have stopped much earlier. As if that wasn't bad enough, here's another strange little twist on the glasses that were found, right? What police would not find out until later was that a man who looked much like the description the police were working with had went to the eye doctor the very next day after Barbara was attacked and murdered. You see, he needed to get a new pair of glasses. He lost his, and he needed them pretty pronto because his eyesight was pretty bad.
He can't see without his glasses.
That's exactly what I thought when I was writing. Yep, exactly. Here's something that just the world. You can't make this stuff up, right? The weird thing is, he goes to the doctor, the eye doctor. That eye doctor was also Barbara's eye doctor, right?
Ooh.
Right? So police go in to the eye doctor to question the eye doctor about Barbara's prescription, right? They find her that she did wear glasses or she needed contacts or whatever. And they go to the doctor and they go in and talk to the doctor about Barbara's prescription because they wanted to rule out the glasses that were found at the scene. But what police did not do is they did not tell the doctor about the glasses that they found at the scene because if they had, they would have had the killer's name, address, and eyeglass prescription because he was in the earlier. You know, the eye doctor didn't put it together, but the police didn't say.
Right. But you know what? They might not have wanted that information out, right? That might be something that they were keeping.
To the public, but I think you might ask.
Maybe. I don't know. Who knows?
Point being, if they
would have asked, they would have known, right?
There
I
you
totally
go.
Get that. Yeah.
Right. People were now aware that there was a killer running loose and targeting women in the park. You know how this goes. The women were diligent to travel in packs, keep aware of their surroundings, you know, never go out alone. But as time passes, you know what happens. People tend to let their guard down. On October 15th, a 26-year-old by the name of Ann Alderson went to the park to enjoy nature and get some fresh air, just as they all do. Later, the park's caretaker would tell police that he remembered seeing Anne sitting in the amphitheater, and it was around dusk. It was around, you know, sundown. And it even occurred to him that he maybe should say something, like yell out and say, hey, remember, you might want to get out of here because we've had some issues around the park as this last year. But he decided against it. He thought that, you know, she was peacefully enjoying her time, and he really didn't want to disturb her. But he did think that. Now, that poor guy, could you imagine? I'm sure that came back to haunt him.
Mm-hmm.
This was also, by the way, the exact area where Etta Kane had been found dead about a year prior. She, too, had been seen in that amphitheater prior to being, I guess, murdered. This murder, again, would be yet different again, right? So Anne was found murdered, and she was, the best way that I try to visualize this in my head, she was kind of propped up on a rock.
Mm-hmm.
One of her earrings were missing, and unlike the others, she had been raped, but she was allowed to redress. So he raped her and then allowed her to put her clothes back on. Now, the one, exactly. Another fact that made police think the killer's the same person who killed Etta Kane, they didn't really release this out a lot, is that the position of each of their bodies were similar because the killer had forced them to get on their knees in front of him. Now, perhaps it's a power move to be standing over them, or perhaps he actually made them beg for their lives.
Oh.
Now, that had not been released, but because of the different means of killing them, they couldn't yet put all these together. But it did seem to be a little bit too much of a coincidence that both...
They were too close together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just too similar, right?
Mm-hmm.
What no one yet knew was that there were more victims this weekend, but it would be some time before they were located. Not too far away from the location where Anne was found, a double homicide occurred, and police believe this suspect may be the same person who committed all of these park murders. It was October 16th, 1980. Two people were found shot to death. Mark McDermott, 35, and his brother Edwin, 40, both resided with their mother, Helen McDermott, 75. Now, a family friend had called police because they were worried about them, hadn't seen them for a while, and asked the police to do a welfare check on them. It's about 8:30 at night. Sheriff's deputies arrive, and they find the body of a man whom they learned was Edwin, the 40-year-old. He had been dead approximately, from what they could guess, 12 hours, and he had several bullet holes in his head and chest. Looking around, the deputies went outside, and they observed a small padlocked door that led into the basement of the house. They forced their entry, and they got in, and they noticed that there was a note tacked kind of on the side of the door. It was addressed to Shit Heels, and it said, by the time that you find the note, this killer is going to be gone. It's going to be way too late. You're out of luck. It was signed Mr. Hate.
Oh, charming.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. So officers, now, was that his given name, or
I think it might have been by marriage.
Yeah,
I think
gotcha.
By marriage. I'm not sure. So officers learned that this was the bedroom of Mark McDermott, and he was the brother. He seemed, I mean, I would have to agree with you, he seemed pretty much like he might be a suspect. There was also a lot of spent .38 caliber casings in his room, along with three live rounds of .22 caliber ammunition and ankle holsters for handguns and a knife.
Hmm.
Not looking too good for you there, Marky.
Yeah, he seems stable.
And that's the end of the story. Nope, just kidding. Within a few days, the local newspapers and the Marion County Sheriff start receiving letters from an individual who claimed responsibility for the murder of Edwin and Edwin's mother. A handwriting expert testified that the person who wrote the letters to the police and the one that was tacked to the back of the door, you know, to Shit Heels, was in fact the same person. The same person had wrote both of those. At this point, police, they need to devise a plan to get him in. So they're thinking that this fella, Mark, was out killing women, right? And then he turned, I guess, the killings on his family, right? Maybe he felt the pressures getting too close or whatever. So police decide to run a letter in the paper, and they are directing it to Mark, giving him a phone number to call in, right? You think he's going to call in, Jen?
He probably may. I mean, he seems like the... type
caller
in
kind.
Check in.
Yeah. So a person calls in and he identifies himself as Mark McDermott. And it was October 24th. He said he would consider giving himself up, but he had some things to do first. Oh, okay. You go ahead and go pick up that dry cleaning and all that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Got to get some milk.
Mm-hmm. So 2 days later, he calls in and he describes some very, very specific details about the killings of Edwin's mother, Mark's mother as well, too. He said that he had to kill his mother and brother quickly, but he'd miscalculated with his brother and ended up having to shoot him 5 or 6 times. Now, he said his motive was to stop Edwin from hurting others and to prevent his mother from realizing that he'd killed Edwin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he agreed to turn himself in the following day. When he approached the police, he was wearing a belt with a .38 caliber revolver in it. He'd also had a set of thumb cuffs. That's so weird. Thumb cuffs. And in his car was a .28 caliber pistol, a 12-gauge shotgun, some ammo, and some other things, including hypodermic needles and vials of insulin because he had diabetes. And, you know, that's just
prepared.
That just kind of struck me kind of odd, right? Like, you're going to go kill people. You're going to do all this stuff. You're going to turn yourself into police, but you got to make sure you have your supply of insulin and needles.
Insulin might have been hard to get then. I don't know. Always prepared. Camille was a Boy Scout.
Boy Scout. I was just going to say that. The investigation was now complete. Police thought they had a good... Thank you. We're on page 3 of 12. So does that tell you anything? They thought that they had a pretty good idea of what happened in the story. So it seems that Edwin, the 40-year-old, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And as he was aging, his mental state, it was
deteriorating.
It wasn't going so well. So Mark started referring to his brother as it or the thing. And he had confided to a friend that he was really worried about his brother because once his mother died, I guess who's going to take care of Edwin? Well, obviously, I mean, I would think it would be the brother. And I guess he didn't want to do that. Mark had borrowed some guns that he used to kill the family, and he had decided he was going to go on the run. But, you know, I think with everything that happened, the mental state, he's not a killer. I mean, he just kind of did this, right? He would come out and say...
It's just a side thing.
Just a side job. So Mark would come out and say, he did this basically putting them out of their misery is what he thought. And how many times have we heard that, right?
Right.
And he would also
say...
But
he was sick.
Yeah, he would also say he blacked out and couldn't quite remember doing this. So the case goes to jury, and of course, the jury finds Mark McDermott guilty on 2 counts of first-degree murder, and he gets the death penalty. Okay, great. He's out.
Case solved.
Case solved. Except for a couple things. None of his weapons match the bullets used on the murder victims, but also, once he was in jail and in custody, the murders continued.
Oh.
So I don't think he could be doing it, right?
Oops. Yeah.
Oops.
Well, one down. They caught somebody, so
they did catch somebody.
Kudos to them.
Did catch a killer.
But not who they were wanting.
Not the one, right? So we're now in late November when this gives me the creepy creepies. I mean, they all give me the creepy creepies, but this is just disturbing, disturbing on a whole nother level. So we're in late November when 4 bodies, that's right, 4 were all discovered in the same day. It looked as if 2 of them, a pair, had been killed together. Right. And another pair had been killed together as well. But the one pair had been killed really recently and the other pair had been killed about a month prior. Yet they found all 4 bodies on the same day. Could you imagine the police?
No.
Right. Hey, Bob, you're not going to believe this.
Bad day at work.
So a young
woman,
I
guess if you're into it, that's a pretty awesome day.
No, it's a terrible day.
I
don't
think
want anybody
it's a terrible
to
day.
Die, right?
But I'm saying if you were into it.
So a young woman named Shauna May was supposed to meet a group of her friends on November 28th, Point Reyes National Seashore Park, to go hiking. Now, this park was a few miles north of San Francisco, and it had not yet had any murders, no killings in there, because all of them had been at Mount Tamalpais Park, right? So when she refused to show up, her friends alerted police officials. It would be 2 days before they found her nude body. She had been tied with some picture frame wire, shot 3 times in the head, and then shoved into a little trench. The autopsy later determined that she had been raped. And you know what is so unusual about these killings? And maybe it's, I don't know why, but they're all just slightly different. And so the guy, the jerk, let's call him the jerk. I don't know if he tried to do that on purpose or if he was just playing. Like, he had to work up to actually raping them. Do you see what I'm saying? I don't
right.
know. Yeah.
Like, he evolved?
Yes.
A little bit?
So close by, so close, in fact, to the point of touching her, was the body of another young woman, 22-year-old Diana O'Connell. She, too, had gone missing while hiking with friends. One friend had been in front of her on the path, and the other friend was just a little ways behind. And she was the last one, and then all of a sudden just kind of disappeared. And that breaks my heart, because, you know, sometimes like when you're walking, I don't know, back when I used to exercise, let's put it that way, right? Sometimes like you want to go faster, the other one wants to go slower, and you're like, no, 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 go ahead. I'll catch up with you.
Right.
And that's what happened, right? And then she just kind of disappeared. So that's the first two that the police discover. Now the day is going to turn out way worse than anybody had ever or could ever anticipate for that matter. During the search, two more bodies were discovered just a half a mile away. Actually, they were found first and both victims had been shot in the head. For the first time, one of the victims was male. They were identified as Richard Stowers, age 19, and Cynthia Moreland, age 18. The couple had been engaged to be married and had gone hiking together in mid-October in an area that Cynthia had reportedly knew quite well. They had been reported missing on October 11th and never were located. They had not been located up until this point. And this all kind of came out because Rick was in the military and he was, I guess, registered, or I don't know how you do that, but he was considered AWOL because he did not show up for his Coast Guard duty when he was supposed to report back.
Absent without leave, yep.
An autopsy placed their time of death just a few days before that of Ann Alderson. So either there were two predators roaming the area, or the same person had gone elsewhere looking for people to murder, right? So he has moved on to yet another park. Then ballistics analysis confirmed what the police had so believed, but actually were, I guess, hoping it was not the case, that the killer of Ann Alderson had also shot May and O'Connell. So now they can tie all three of these together. There is one person that is stalking people at two beautiful parks in Northern California at this point. So hikers are warned, again, in both parks and other parks, don't hike alone. Make sure you have other people with you. If you can, you know, go in a group, or better yet, go somewhere else, that'd be great. But, you know, Stowers and Moreland, she had a guy with her. So you would think that it's just unreal when you find out this one guy could do all this. You know what I'm saying? Do you see where I'm trying to go with this?
I do.
And I just now thought of this. I wonder if because of he doing his stalking and murdering at Mount Tamalpais, if he's like, okay, I'm going to go to another park because police are going to be there. The presence is going to be bigger. People are going to be more worried about me, right?
Are on the lookout. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Police comb the area and they are able to find some witnesses and make a composite drawing to show, I guess, the media and other people what they came up with. However, it was difficult because a lot of the witnesses, they couldn't, you know, eyewitness testimony is pretty brutal. It's pretty hard to do things, you know, to get everybody to say the same thing. So it was kind of a willy-nilly kind of description of the guy. The age was, you know, maybe he's in his mid-20s. No, he's in his mid-50s. He had a little bit of hair. No, he was bald. You know what I'm saying? So it was a little, it wasn't a whole lot to go on, right? Many people at this point are starting to get a little, and this could not come at a better time since we had this breaking news, and I remember you putting it on Facebook and stuff, I think a day or two ago. So many people in San Francisco area recall an earlier series of murders that had never been solved, and now people are beginning to speculate and wonder if that killer had once again risen his ugly head and is now doing the same thing to people in the parks.
Are we talking about the Zodiac
We
killer?
Sure are.
Who we still don't know, but his cipher has been...
I know, and he did not reveal anything of goodness.
Like just that he's a bad speller. Yeah, that's all.
Right, it was like nothing. But, I was like, we waited 50 years for that.
Hey, but it's still something that might help. You never know. Any little thing might help break the case now. There might be things, believe it or not, that we don't know. Who knows?
Hopefully, I would think they would not tell us everything. I would hope not anyway. All right. So let's take a quick look at this. Between December 1968 and July 1969, and this is a full-on decade before the Trailside murders, a man shot two couples in Vallejo, California on two separate occasions and called to actually take credit for one. One young man had survived to give a description. Then the editors of three different San Francisco papers each received part of a strange letter claiming to be from the Vallejo killer. And the killer, interestingly enough, used too much postage, I guess, to ensure it would get there. And the printed cryptogram was made up of symbols and ciphers and all that. And the, as we all know, was signed with a crossed circle, like, what is that, gun sight symbol?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they came together to try to figure out things. And as you stated just 2 days ago on Facebook, that somebody solved it. Also, Mike Morford. Is that how you say his last name? Like, he got all that.
Morphs.
Right? He's getting
Those guys were in his
used
group.
Used his thing.
His Facebook group. I know. It's amazing. And Mike,
shocking.
He's the nicest guy.
You don't think he really is. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure he created that little, you know, fan site to, you know, sleuth it for sleuths and look
what
happened.
Well, he did the podcast, Criminology, the Zodiac Killer.
Mm-hmm.
He's like all into the Zodiac Killer. So,
crazy.
It's amazing. And kudos to him and kudos to those three men who solved the cipher. It's amazing.
Makes us realize that, Jen, we can do a podcast and we can get an episode out every week.
That's about it. Barely.
And that's it.
Barely.
Yeah. So the killer, Jen, as we know, called himself the Zodiac. And on September 27th, 1969, Cecilia, which I think is the cutest name, Cecilia Ann Shepherd and her friend Brian Hartnell were picnicking at Lake Berryessa, where a man wearing a black executioner's hood approached them. He stabbed them, attacking the girl repeatedly. And afterward, of course, because he's a jerk too, called the police to report it. He struck again 2 weeks later, killing a cab driver named Paul Stein. The San Francisco Chronicle received a letter with a torn piece of Stein's shirt. Could you imagine that? I remember that scene in the Zodiac TV show because it's a bloody, like, piece of shirt. It's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, no leads proved productive, and there was speculation at this point that the same killer who had done all these murders and called himself the Zodiac was back in town and back at it again, right?
Yeah, but you would think that if it really was the Zodiac killer, he would be tooting his horn and saying, look what I did.
Exactly. He would be, because he was too cocky. He'd be sending letters, right?
Yeah, he would have probably sent letters before he started shooting.
Right. Many different suspects were developed, but none checked out. The case proved to be one of the rare times when a serial murderer appeared to be quite clever, well-educated, and making his crimes into a layered series of games. It was a game to him, which is, I just can't. At that point, at the end of his, I guess, reign, started to lay low, and that's it. Nobody could ever find him. Here's where I bring in our guy, John Douglas. Right.
I
mentioned him a couple times throughout here because
he and I are buddies, you know.
I know you are. This is my first mention of Mr. Douglas here. He had suggested that possibly the Zodiac killer had been arrested for something, and that's why he was no longer doing what he liked to do, I guess. The Zodiac, as you mentioned earlier, the Zodiac killer, he liked to claim what he did, right? And nobody was doing that. And that was a big difference in the Trailside murders, the Trailside killings. Nobody was claiming that they did that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So winter passed without further murders, or that anybody knew of, but they would sadly learn this was not the case. Police were working on the investigation, even though nothing was happening. They had no new leads. They were running out of things to do. So it was about at this point that they call in a man by the name of Mr. John Douglas to, I guess, confer with to try to get some ideas. Now, this is 1980, 1981, and the profiling, it's just starting to take off, starting to become a thing.
Right.
And let me say, I know there's people out there that really believe in murder profiling, and there's other people that think it's hogwash, that it's just, you know, you're going to hit things on the head. So I'm just putting that out there for what it is. But on this one, he nailed it. I will say that. So here we go. His profile, what he had to say about all of this, I think it's in the Mindhunter book. I'll put it in the show notes. I can't remember, but I kind of condensed it to much more smaller because it was about 3 pages long. So summing his actual profile up of what investigators should be looking into. John Douglas believed, since the murders were all in wooded areas of the park, the person had to be familiar with the area. Due to the way he attacked his victims, often from behind, Blitz style, he believed that the person was not very attractive and not very comfortable with his looks. He wasn't very confident. Since the murders took place out of sight, Douglas felt that they were strangers and unknown to the killer. These were simple crimes of opportunity. The killer went out hunting, and he was bound and determined to find somebody that day, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, it is hard when, and we know this, we've talked about this, when you murder somebody that there's no connection with, it's much harder to solve because they always start with your inner circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Douglas believed that the killer had done some prison time and had sort of a rap sheet, had a bad background. He'd probably been arrested for attempted rape or maybe even rape. The killer would be Caucasian because all the victims were white, and typically a killer stays within their own race when they murder. Typically. Not always, but typically. Douglas also believed that the killer was above average intelligence. He did work, but it wasn't a really high profile job, more like blue collar or maybe like in a factory or something like that. He would add that he also had a history of bedwetting, arson, and or harm to animals. He would at least have two of these, if not all three. But the big thing that the investigators found weird with his report was that Douglas believed the killer would have a speech impediment. He figured that the killer had a disability of some sort, but how the killer attacked his victims was he was able-bodied, okay? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like he was missing a limb or had a severe limp. He believed that it was a disability that would allow him to attack people and get away with it, but that the disability would be something he could easily hide. And coming around to all of that, putting that all together, he believed that he would have some sort of speech impediment. Well, needless to say, the investigators were like, yeah, right.
Hey. I'm like sitting here thinking, yeah, okay. I don't understand how that his actions would make John Douglas think, oh, yeah, he's got a speech impediment.
Uh-huh. Funny, huh?
Interesting.
Okay. Interesting. So just put that little feather in
there.
But
my brain doesn't think like that. My brain doesn't think half the time anyway, but yeah. It doesn't think in ways like John Douglas's brain does.
I know. So it is now March 29th, 1981, when college students Ellen Marie Hansen and Stephen Hartle are hiking in Henry Cowell Redwoods State Park. Now, for those of you keeping count, this is our third park that we've visited in Northern California. Now, this area is about 80 miles south of San Fran, and it is close to Santa Cruz. Now, Santa Cruz is, if you remember, that's a little California town that has had a little dark history with killers as well in the early 70s. Edmund Kemper, John Lindley Frazier, and Herbert Mullen had killed there around the same time. Frazier targeted the family. Kemper killed co-eds, and Mullen imagined that he had to sacrifice people to protect the state of California from earthquakes.
Yep.
So it's been nearly a decade after that, and Santa Cruz is the cutest little town. And it really is. It's so cute. I loved it. All these guys are behind bars, but I can't imagine the people of Santa Cruz are like, are you kidding me again? Right? I mean, that's what I'd be
thinking. Got another one. Yeah.
However,
I'd be thinking, F me. Are you kidding me? Yeah.
However, this one's a little different because guess what? Thank goodness. Steve Hartle lives to tell his story.
Oh, good.
Steve would tell officers that a man approached he and Ellen as they were hiking. The man had a pistol in his hand. He threatened them with it and wanted them to come off the trail and go down into the woods. Well, at first they kind of started to do that, but then they fought it a little bit. The man would tell them that he simply wanted to rape Ellen and that he would let them go. But he wanted Steve to allow that. Could you imagine? I don't think so. So Ellen, and this is heartbreaking, she looked at Steve and basically said, listen, he's going to kill us no matter what. And she was right. So they kind of fought him and were like, absolutely not. At this point, Steve is begging the man to just let us go. The man lifted his gun, shot Hartle, and then shot Hansen point blank twice in the head, once in the shoulder. They both obviously fell to the ground. Hartle was horrified and was unable to get away as the stranger shot them. But thank goodness, the bullets burrowed through his neck, but he was not killed. The man fled. And Stephen Hartle was able to get some help from other hikers.
Thank goodness.
Right?
Poor Ellen, but thank goodness.
To live through that? I just can't even. Oh my gosh. At this point, Steve was able to give a great description of his attacker. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was very shocking. I'm sure he was stunned, but he had reported that a man that had popped out, he described him, little hair, dark glasses, mid-40s, and then later other witnesses would step forward and say they would go with that description and say, yes, we saw a man that fit that description near the observation deck. And when we heard gunshots, we ran in the direction of that area and we actually saw a car drive off and it looked like it was a red car of a foreign make, right? Mm-hmm. So this was way different than the description that they had had from Mount Tamalpais with the guy with the hawk nose, right?
Did they say anything about did Steve say anything about a speech impediment?
Nope. But we're going to find out. We're going to find out something about that pretty soon. So authorities decide that they need to get this, I guess, flyer description out to as many places in that area as they can. So they send the composite drawing to all the newspapers, the TV stations, and all that. They want people to be on alert, but they also want to know if anybody knows who this guy might be. Any neighbors, any family, anything like that. 4 days later, just 4 days later, they get a hit. I'm telling you, how all this comes together, I just don't know. I don't, and you know, to be an officer, a detective, I guess, working a case, it has to be 24/7.
It's like, this would all always, consuming.
It would be in your head always, mm-hmm. always thinking, what'd you miss? What'd you get? Right?
Right.
So anyway.
Or what is X? How does X go with Z?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They get that hit. Thank goodness. A woman calls in to describe a man who resembled the sketch. And she tells them that she had been on a cruise to Japan. And this was, you ready? About 26 years ago. And she confronted this guy, this man, his name was David Carpenter, because he worked on the boat and he had been bothering her daughter with just being weird, inappropriate behavior, kind of following her around and all that stuff.
Okay, I can see how she would remember that then.
And it creepy, gave her the creeps. I mean, she reported him. But the one distinctive thing, she recalled that he had a severe stutter. Uh-huh. And the reason she had the name of this person was because, you know, when you're on cruises, you've been on a cruise, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you get like, sometimes you get like a book, a little keepsake or whatever. And mm-hmm. this guy had signed her book and it was David Carpenter. So that's how she was able to remember his name for 26 years. David Carpenter had seen the sketch in the paper at about the same time. And he decided that he needs to grow out a beard to change his looks, right? That'll change everything.
It will.
He makes a mistake and it's a big one. He kills again because, you know, just like killers do, he gets a little bit too brave, a little bit too sloppy. He'd always killed with strangers, not knowing them, not being able to make the connection. Well, boy, he done did mess up because he killed somebody much closer to home. And this mistake would be his downfall. On May 2nd, Heather Roxanne Skaggs, age 20, tells her boyfriend that she's going to see this guy named David Carpenter about a used car. She needed a car. And she knew David. She wasn't great friends with him, but she knew of him. And we'll get to that in a minute. But David Carpenter had said, hey, you know, I have a friend and he's selling a car and I'll take you to go see it. And, you know, if you need a little loan or whatever, I'll give you a little money to help do that. Now, the reason they knew each other was Heather was a student at, it's called Econo Quick Print, which is basically different age, right? So this is like a computer typesetting machine company thing. And she was going to school to do that. And he actually would go and fix their computers and things like that. So she knew of him, but not really well, right? And during one of their passing meetings, she had mentioned that she needed a car of her own. And so he remembered this and said, hey, I got a car for you. My friend's doing it. And so, you know, she was like, well, you know, I don't know. I don't really have the money. And he's like, I'll help you. I'll help pay for it. Of course, right? So he kind of pressured her basically into going to see this. I mean, I'm going to get you a car and I'm going to pay for it. Okay, well, Heather's telling her boyfriend this, and her boyfriend, whose name is Dan, was like, seems a little weird. I think I might like the phone number and the address of this guy, just, you know. And also, can you give me the time that you can return? Because that's just a little odd. In fact, David said, you know what? Let me go with you. And she's like, no. I mean, I know him. He's harmless. Big nerd. He's harmless, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we all know what happens. She did not return home. And so Dan went looking for her, had that address and everything, and went to confront Carpenter at his home. Well, David Carpenter says, you know, we were supposed to meet up and she never showed up. So I didn't see her. I went out to go meet her. We were supposed to meet up and go see that car, and she never showed up. Well, Dan was like, I'm getting a weird vibe. That's really weird. And frantically calls the police. He knew that Carpenter had instructed Heather. This talk about red flags that you mentioned a couple episodes ago. David Carpenter had instructed Heather, hey, don't tell anyone where we're going to meet and bring $400 for the car.
Oh, yeah. But she's young and...
You know, right, 20. And if you kind of know the guy, you're going to be thinking, yeah, what's he going to do, right? So after Dan...
And I'm sure he seemed harmless.
Well, when you see him, you'd think, yeah, right, I could take him. I mean, of course.
Right.
That's what... You know what I'm saying. You always think that about them. How many times does this go? They looked harmless, right?
And or they worked with him and they thought they knew them. I know. It's the same story, but it's still... I would fall for it. You would fall for it.
No, totally.
You know, yeah.
So Dan goes back to the police and he's like, something is not right. So police, you know, pull up David Carpenter. And guess what? He's got a record. It seems like he had a little sex offender problem. Okay.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So the police decide, hey, let's go spy on this guy. We're going to start watching him. So the FBI, along with some other local police departments, agencies, set up surveillance van outside of the house at 36 Sussex Street in San Fran, where David Joseph Carpenter, age 51, lives with his elderly parents, both mom and dad. Now, they secretly, I couldn't imagine having this job either. They start following him everywhere he goes, and they make notes of what he does, who he talks to, when he leaves, his schedule, I guess, if you will. Well, they decide the time's arrived, and they're gonna go talk to him. So they go up, knock on the door. He comes to the door. He literally seems like a deer in headlights. They decide, what? We're going to take you in. We're going to arrest you. And at that point, do you know what this huge, wimpy jerk says to police officers?
Mm-mm.
Please don't hurt me. That was his only comment. Jesus. Please don't hurt me. I know I've murdered all these people and raped them, but please don't hurt me.
I deserve better treatment than everybody that I've treated poorly.
In David Carpenter's car, which is, guess what, a red Fiat, which is a foreign-made automobile, just like that one witness said, they find books and maps about all the nearby parks and hiking trails. In addition to the maps and realizing that the car is a foreign-made car, just like the witness said, they realize that he, at this point, that he had the same eye doctor as the other Barbara Schwartz, the victim.
They're putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
They had that, like... clicking, aha.
Click, 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 click. Yep, they realized he had the record for the violent sex crimes. He had suffered from rages, explosive rages, and freaking out. They realized he tried to change his look with growing that beard. Like you said, it's all coming together. You're going down, buddy, right? You're going down. But there's going to be a little time to it, of course. So police put him in a lineup where Stephen Hurdle, along with some of the other witnesses, come into the station. And poor Stephen, I couldn't imagine sitting... looking across at this guy and say, you tried to kill me and you killed my girlfriend. Like, I'm going to kill you, right? So they do identify him, this man, as the person that killed them or attempted to murder them, whatever the case may be.
And that has to be traumatic for the victims to see.
Terribly,
him
right?
Could you imagine?
Yeah. That's what I mean. I mean, that would be a whole nother year of therapy sessions on that one, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So David Carpenter was formally charged in the murder and attempted murder in Santa Cruz. At his arraignment, he stuttered so badly, he couldn't even answer the judge's question. And basically the questions were, is your name David Carpenter? Do you testify that your name is David? And he couldn't even say yes.
He was
right?
Nervous. He was nervous.
Mm-hmm.
So his stutter came out more. Yeah. He should be nervous, for damn sake.
On Sunday, May 24th, remains were found in Big Basin Redwoods Park. Her body had been hidden under brush. The body was positively identified as Heather Skaggs. She had been raped and shot once through the eye with a .38. Ugh. So who is this David fella and what happened to him?
Uh-huh.
Born on May 6, 1930 in San Fran, David Carpenter had been raised by a strict parent. His father was an alcoholic who, I guess, he claims, beat him and neglected him. And his mother was very domineering and controlling. By the time
Seems to be a thing.
Thank you. By the time he was seven, he was stuttering so badly that this made school and, you know, making friends, I'm sure of it, terrible. Because of this, he's ridiculed and he became painfully withdrawn. He didn't receive any therapy, but his father forced him to participate in extracurricular activities. Now, you'd think this would be a good thing, but these activities were ballet and piano. Now, if you wrapping it back to TV, because that's what I do, he had a small little part in Mindhunter where he is telling Holden and the detectives on the Mindhunter show. This is the Netflix special about his dad forcing him to take ballet lessons. So David Carpenter was in that. And part of the reason I love Mindhunter so much is that often when you're watching that show, you don't make the connection to who these people are. You know what I'm saying? And I love that. Uh-huh. I love that little game they played like that. And when David Carpenter was little, he would take out his violence and anger on animals. And he also was a bedwetter. He wet the bed growing well into adolescence, right? He started.
And I just want to say there's nothing wrong with taking ballet.
No, God, no. This was
piano.
A different time, too. You know what I mean? And I guess.
There is those strict gender roles back then, but also the kid's shy. So taking ballet and piano and having to do those recitals, that would kill him inside do it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the other side, his dad probably thought. But I don't know. David probably thought his dad was being mean, forcing him to do this. Whereas as a parent, I would be like, I'm doing this to try to help you break out of your shell. But that's
exactly
us as normal people. For the normal, I use that term loosely, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. And he probably, and we have no background in psychiatry or anything like that. But I would think that he just probably thought it was another form of punishment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Or torture that his strict dad was doing.
Yeah, made him suffer even more, right?
Exactly.
So by the time David was 17, he was arrested for molesting two young children. These two young children, Jen, were his cousins. He served
easy
a year.
Targets, or not easy targets, but readily available.
Exactly.
I guess.
He served a year, and sadly, I mean, this is not going to end, right? Once he was out, he did get married in 1955. But he was still stalking. He was still doing things that probably a lot of people didn't come forward and talk about because of the time.
Inappropriate things.
Yeah. Right. He went to work on a ship, like we said earlier, a salesman. And then he was a printer and a printer workman, which is how he knew Heather Skaggs. This comes out. He had apparently a very high sex drive. And So apparently he thought by getting married, that poor wife, it would help control his hunger, his need for that sex all the time. They did end up having three children together, but eventually he couldn't lead a normal life. Let's put it that way. So he began prowling and looking for women. In one incident in 1960, Carpenter, you know, made friends with this lady. Hey, it's all good. And said, hey, you want to come over to my house and meet my wife and my kids and all that stuff, and it'd be great.
Look how normal I am.
Since they were friends, he often gave her a ride to work. So one day he comes and gets her, and he's going to take her to work. And instead, he makes a different turn. He drove to a wooded area near the Presidio, which is located near the Golden Gate Bridge, again. And he was pretending, hey, I'm lost. I don't know where I am, right? Oh, yeah, buddy. Mm-hmm. Don't fall for that one. At some point during this, he grabbed her and he was trying to bind her up with the clothesline wire. And he was threatening her. He pulled out a knife and he was telling her, just be quiet, just be quiet, just be quiet. He told her that he had, quote, a funny quirk that needed to be satisfied. Hey, buddy. Thank you.
Haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, right. All right. I don't fall for that one. Mm-mm. When she resisted and tried to get away, he struck her several times with a hammer.
A hammer?
Mm-hmm. The woman would report, and this is just scary, and this goes back to all this. During all of this, during the control, during the fighting, during the violence, He lost his stutter. His stutter was gone. She would say that his speech was slow and deliberate and very demanding, very concentrated, right? Angry. But, you know, this is, he's in control, right? So he's not that goofy little kid that's withdrawn and, you know, he is in control. He's getting what he wants. This woman probably would have been David Carpenter's first murder victim. However, thank goodness there was a military patrol officer and he heard some crying. He heard some woman yelling. So he goes out and he sees them and he pulls them over. He gets Carpenter out of the car. David Carpenter takes out a gun and shoots at him, missing, thank goodness. And the patrol officer returned fire and wounded Carpenter. What? So then the military police officer arrested Carpenter and took him in. The victim survived, thank goodness. And Carpenter, shockingly says he doesn't know anything. He doesn't remember any of this. He must have had some sort of seizure and blacked out. I don't remember anything. Yeah, good luck, buddy. Well, you are going to get 14 years in prison to try to figure out what happened. So he gets a 14-year sentence and goes to jail. Now, of course, during this time, his wife is like, okay, buddy, the sex all the time, the temper tantrums, the demands, I'm done. We're out. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. So she divorces him. Thank goodness. Psychiatrists would come on board and evaluate him. And they said that he would, you know, he would say that it was a lover's quarrel and that was his girlfriend. And then he'd say it was amnesia. And then he said, you know, I think maybe I have a brain tumor. Something's wrong with me. I go dark and I don't remember what I do. Yeah, right, buddy. Mm-hmm.
Excuses, excuses, excuses.
Right.
I believe there is something wrong with his brain, but not what he's doing. Yeah.
He serves just 9 years of that 14-year sentence, and it's 1969, and he's out. He gets married, or remarried, shall I say, and it is less than a year, and he is at it again. He was out there. So he tries to rape a woman by hitting her car to force her out of it, and when she struggles and tries to get away, he stabs her, but she manages to get back in the car, thank goodness, and take off, right? So he would have had so many more victims. Carpenter at this point now is like, listen, I need to rape women, but I need to not get caught because I do not want to go back to prison. So in order to do that, I'm going to have to go cure my sex drive in the woods with strangers, and then I'm going to have to kill them. So they're not left to, you know, come back and say it's me and then get rid of me, right? So he continues to kind of taunt women and is again arrested in Modesto, California on February 3rd, 1970 for, again, attempted rape, but failing, thank goodness. While awaiting his trial, he decides to, let's bust out of here. Let's bust out of this jail.
Oh,
so
smart.
He and four other inmates decide to, let's bust out of here. So they get out, but now he's got 7 years on top of seven more years in addition to, you know, what he had with that woman's. So he has 7 years for now kidnap and robbery. He ends up with two more years on top of that for violating parole things. So he now is out in May 1979, and at this point, due to technical paperwork errors, he wasn't officially listed as a sex offender. That's in May, right? By August, he killed Etta Kane, the first victim. Well, the first one I talked about, rather. It was June 16th, 1981, when some rock climbers were enjoying a hike in Castle Rock State Park. They stumble upon a bone, what they think is a jawbone, actually. So they alert police and they give it to them for analysis. It turns out it is human, and it comes out that it is the jawbone of a 17-year-old girl named Anna K. Mahiver, and she had been missing since December 28th of the previous year. Many people had suspected that David Carpenter had something to do with her disappearance because she worked part-time at the bank where he was a client. And he would often chit-chat with her. And they were just, I don't know, they all felt strongly that he should be investigated regarding her disappearance and or murder. But that never really came about, right? Point being is we don't really know how many victims he had altogether. So David Carpenter was formally charged with the Marin County killings. And that's Ann Alderson, Diane O'Connell, Shauna May, Cynthia Moreland, and Richard Stovers. He was also charged with two rapes and an attempted rape. The police recovered the .38 he had given to a friend who was a bank robber. And the bank robber was like, listen, it's one thing to rob banks, but I am in no way covering and protecting, giving you an alibi, right? So he goes and he gives that gun to police officers. So they have all that. It's a strong case, let's be honest, right? David Carpenter, of course, insisted he was innocent, and he continued to do so throughout two trials. That's right, two trials. The first trial was for the murders of Heather Skaggs and Ellen Hansen and the attempted murder of Stephen Hardall. The trial began on October 11th, 1983. The judge decided to have one jury decide his guilt and a second jury, which is unusual, I thought, decide the penalty in the event of a conviction. So this was a lot of people to, I guess, decide David Carpenter's fate, if you will. So David Carpenter's gun had, in fact, been linked to each of the murders. And Stephen Hardall's testimony, well, that's kind of a humdinger, right? That's, I looked you in the face as you shot and killed my girlfriend, and I saw you. Bada bing, bada boom, you gotta go.
It was you, yeah.
So after 6 weeks of testimony, the 8-woman, 4-man jury deliberated for 8 hours over the course of 2.5 days to reach their verdict.
Wow.
That's a long time, right? I thought that
was a long time with that evidence, yeah.
Right? On July 6th, 1984, David Carpenter was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of attempted murder. The second jury found that the 3 necessary special circumstances that could warrant a death penalty had been met, and that was committing multiple murders, committing during a rape, and lying in wait. Carpenter was, in fact, given the death sentence via execution in San Quentin's gas chamber. The second trial opened in San Diego. And notice that they put that in a different location.
Right.
As if they would know about it. I would think this would have been huge news, but that's okay.
I would think so also.
The second trial opened in San Diego on January 5th, 1988. After 7 hours of deliberation, the jury also recommended the death sentence for him. All is right in the world, right, Jen?
You would think so.
Yep, wrong. The jury foreman, Barbara Durham, said, she said a little something that maybe could have affected things. You see, she told friends that she knew about or had become aware during the trial that Carpenter had been convicted in Los Angeles in 1984 for the Santa Cruz murders. She had concealed this fact during the trial. So the judge had to decide, what are we going to do? Should there be a mistrial? The judge was, I mean, he was pretty confident. We all are. I think it's safe to say we all are. He did this, right?
Right.
But being fair and just, because that's what you are when you're a judge, he had to inform them that he considered this a travesty of justice, especially because the trial had cost so much money and caused so much heartache. But because of her, they needed a new trial.
Somebody wasn't very popular that year.
Right. You know.
Could you imagine how...
Right.
I think I would send her a hate letter.
Right?
So, yeah. I mean, that's pretty crappy.
In 1984, state prosecutors asked the California Supreme Court in San Fran to overturn that decision. Since the evidence for Carpenter's guilt was, overwhelming. I mean, he might say he was innocent, but nobody else was. The deputy state public defender insisted that the jury had been contaminated and that the trial had been essentially biased, unfair. On March 6th, 1995, the court refused to give David Carpenter a new trial. Thank you. I mean, he was already convicted of the other one, so what's the difference?
Right.
Just keep him in there, right?
But still, it's the families of the other victims they want to seek justice for.
I get that. So yeah. Justice Armand Arabian, that's an awesome name, by the way, stated that it's virtually impossible to keep secrets in such a high-profile case. And even though he believed that the knowledge she had should have been revealed, and I mean, to be a good person and do the right thing, they should have all known that. But he also believed it didn't really bias the jury. So he overturned Judge Hoffman's decision. And no new trial for you, buddy. So in 1997, the state Supreme Court upheld the death penalty for the Skaggs and Hansen murders. And on November 29th, 1999, they also upheld Carpenter's death penalty from the second trial. 6 of the 7 judges agreed that it had been a fair trial and sentenced properly. You got the right sentence, buddy. So, you'd think he's dead, right? Like he's gone a long time ago, right?
Oh, no, because I think I know what happens next. Didn't California get rid of the death penalty?
No.
No, they didn't?
No.
They didn't stay the execution?
Today, David Carpenter remains on death row in San Quentin, awaiting the exhaustion of his appeals through the federal courts. At age 90, he is the oldest inmate in the state of California on death row. And I knew that. Okay, so here's the backstory of this whole story. I have that mystery murder class I do, and I created all of this to go with them because I wanted them to be a profiler, right? And so I left out, it was like a 2-week ordeal, but I took out a bunch of the details and I made them create a profile just like John Douglas did without telling them all of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think they did this like back in October, and I was shocked. I was like, he is still alive? So then today I double checked. Yep, still alive. Do you believe that?
Well, when didn't California get rid of the death penalty or the execution?
That was in the 70s.
Okay.
Yeah. And this was...
Because I remember the whole 80s. Manson thing that he was put in, you know, he was given a stay of execution because it was commuted to life, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Huh. Right?
Interesting. So he's like 90-something now?
He's 90. Age of 90. Currently the oldest inmate on death row. Yep. And so that is the story of David Carpenter, a.k.a.
Wow.
Jerk face. So I did base a lot of this, and I'll put it in the notes. I combined it. Like I said, I created this for my class, and I did it. I had to do it all backwards, basically. So I would release victims and their murder scenes, and they had to be investigators. So I would release the name and the how they were murdered and all that to give, like, the woods, the different angles, the blitz attack, different parts. So I gave all that, right? And I released that. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go and look at John Douglas's profile. And then they had to create a profile of their own based on all their stuff that I've been teaching them about.
Well, that's cool. Murder. And this isn't your English class. This is what class?
Mystery murder class. Crime. I call it my crime class. My murder class.
That's awesome.
Right, yeah. So is it?
Those kids are lucky to have such a fun class like
well,
that.
Well, it is. And they like it. Like, they're totally into it. So, and then they were... the biggest shock for them was that, number one, this was a real case, and number two, he was still alive.
Yeah, that's a shocker. I really thought that, I would have thought that he was...
So that's what, 1980 gone. To 1920, or 2020, so 40 years-ish. Not a little bit less than that, but, I mean, the crimes happened 40 years ago.
Wow. Well, good job. Good job. That would have been a fun class. You did good on that.
So this is what I was going to say. See, there's my ADD. Robert Graysmith, who also wrote the Zodiac book, wrote a book, and I'll put it in the show notes. I think it's called The Lady Sleeping, and that's what they call Mount Tamalpais, because it looks like the mountain looks like a lady sleeping. But a lot of this information came from that book, so giant kudos to him. Obviously, there is a lot to this, but I condensed it all down. So that's it, Jen, and I think we got tomorrow, we got you at day 8. It's going to be a doozy, as it always is. Until tomorrow, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Vane. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
It was October 16th, 1980, my birthday, and two people were found shot to death.
Were 20, right?
Not 20. 11. Shut up. So he goes to trial, and of course, the jury finds Mark McDermott guilty of two counts of first-degree murder.
Not bitter. That's worse. Damn. Oof. There's a huge sentence
first degree
on mitter.
So an autopsy. If I say so one more time, I'm gonna kill myself.
It's like I know.
It's like a comma.
So, I know.
It's like it's like you can't do a transition to a paragraph without saying so.
Or I do so and now.
God.
Or, okay, now. Yeah, I know.
I must be an idiot to talk to in real life. That's all I gotta say.
Oh, you are.
I know. You know I struggle with that unsolved thing. I can't. It just bugs me. Back to the story. Because I was just going to ask you about my boyfriend Madison from the murder on Madison Hill or whatever that lake, whatever.
Yeah, I haven't seen that anymore. Murder
you
Beach.
You haven't seen any of it? You haven't seen
no.
any of it?
I've been working
Girl,
on this. I've been working on it.
I need somebody to watch it so I can talk to them.
I will do it. I have to watch one more episode of the Great British Bake Off Christmas special, and then I will get on it while I do. I will clean. I have to clean this week anyway because my house is a sty.
Well, put in earbuds and put it on your phone and take it around with you. That's what I do.
I'll just put it on the TV and
clean. Yeah. Okay. Back to the story. Focus, Camille. Focus. Here's where I bring in our guy, John Douglas. Right.
Well, you know,
I mentioned him a couple times throughout here because
he and I are buddies, you know.
I know you are.
I always have to say this. He's my brush with greatness. I've met him when Mindhunter, the book, came out spoke with him for a bit. I was working in sales at a book wholesaler and he came in to sign his book. So we did the old push and pull thing, which basically means somebody puts a book in front of him, he signs it, somebody pulls it away. Mm-hmm. And so I was right by him helping him do that and talking while he was signing. And he was really, of course, very interesting to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so. The stories he must have. Okay, back
and
to me.
Can I tell you, though, he was like really easy to get off subject. Like there's so much going on in his brain that you mm-hmm. ask him one thing and he talks about it for 5 minutes and then he like wanders off and the next thing
segues
you know.
Something else. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, so. You know what? We should do an episode where we start every single sentence with so.
That would drive me crazy.
Yeah.
Ellen, Bo Bellin.
Got lots of names floating around in here.
Ellen,
at least they're easy to say. That's all I'm going to say about that.